Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Thursday edition. Today's date is the 26th day of August, 2010. My name is Daryl Bradford-Smith. Great to have you back here for another installment of the French Connection. Still trying to get the story out. We have a returning guest to do a second half of a conversation we started a week ago. Her name is Nancy Turner Banks, MD, a friend of mine, great doctor, spent her whole career serving communities that were under stress, and she learned a lot about the problems that the allopathic system didn't address. And from those experiences, she had questions, and those questions turned into research, and from research turned into a book. And we have been talking with Nancy continuously now for a couple of years regarding many of these very subjects, such as the AIDS virus or so-called AIDS virus, and the control of the medical system, how we got into the place we are. You know, there's not a single person in the United States who is not concerned about this new ridiculous health care bill that was passed. The cost of it is absolutely foolish. It benefits the big insurers and the big drug companies, and does nothing to address the underlying problems in the medical system, with a huge boondoggle cost layer placed upon every single citizen in the country. A lot of states are fighting back. A lot of people are saying it's unconstitutional, but, of course, they own the courts as well, so very hard to get your case heard. And what we're going to do here is we're going to go back, and we got up through Chapter 8 in her book. We talked a lot about the Flexner brothers and how they organized through the Rockefeller Institute, the medical system, and we discussed the economic implications of it all the way from its beginnings, all the way through the East India Company for the British, the opium, and all the connections that go back to many of the crooks that we have talked about on the French Connection for the last 5-6 years. So, you know, one of the other things I want you to know, I'm not going to be posting any new news stories on my website for a, goodness knows, maybe a day or two more. I've had a computer failure. It's broken. I don't exactly know how bad the damage is. I'm hoping the motherboard of my computer is not seriously damaged. However, it's fried somehow. And it's offline completely, can't get the thing going, so got to bring it in tomorrow and have the technician take a look at what can be done to save it, because goodness knows if it's the whole system, I've got a lot of work to do. It'll be days and days before I can get back on track here. I have 11 gigabytes of information to reload if that's the case, and I hope that isn't the case. Anyway, just, you know, some small problems. This happens. If I buy another computer, it'll be my fourth computer in 6 years. So this is just one of the hazards of the job. Anyway, I'm going to bring up my guest right now and get right into this information. Nancy, are you with me?
Yeah. Hi, Daryl. How are you today?
Great.
A little warm, I understand.
I am. I'm cooking up here. We've got some high 90s weather up in the top of my loft, and got a heat wave hitting central France right now. And I was just talking to somebody in the south of France. It's over 40 degrees where he is, so not comfortable. However,
oh, you're talking in centigrade, right?
Yes, centigrade, 40 degrees centigrade. Yeah, which is
that's hot.
That is, it gets roasting. Up here where I am is almost that. So I'm kind of sitting in a pool here, but that's okay. We're going to go right back into your book, Nancy, on Chapter 9, where you start talking about one of the major architects of this crime wave that we've experienced in the last 40 years. That's Henry Kissinger. You know, everybody seems to think that Nixon had some good qualities, but you know, the fact of the matter is, between him and Armand Hammer going to Russia, selling off, secrets to the Russians, not selling them, giving them, of our technology, and the special deals going with Mao over in China. According to Eustace Mullins, China has been one of the world's great producers of opium and drugs for the export in the world. And the Vietnam War being a boondoggle and a farce and just a way to funnel money to these gangs. Where do you want to pick up the story with Kissinger, Nixon, and China?
I really want to talk a little bit about Nixon and how he even got to Congress, because one of the things that you've talked about quite a bit is the Federal Reserve. And there was a congressman who served before Nixon in his district, and his name was Jerry Voorhees. I don't know if you've ever discussed Congressman Voorhees before?
I have heard of him, but no, I haven't discussed him, no.
Well, he was important because he was one of the few congresspeople who really understood the impact that the Federal Reserve would have on the American economy. And he wrote a little book called Out of Debt, Out of Danger, in which he said, it's interesting that people say that borrowing money at and creating debt is sound economics, but printing your own money, which a sovereign nation can do without creating any debt, is bad economics. And so his book is very easy to read. It's called Out of Debt, Out of Danger. But after he wrote that book, of course, he became a problem for the bankers, because the book was very easy to read and it was something that the American people could understand. So he was targeted, and Nixon, who had been in the military and really hadn't lived in California for quite some time, was identified as one of those what I call useful idiots. He was someone who was identified as someone who could be manipulated. And so the bankers put their money behind Nixon, and of course he won. So I think that's a little aside that most people don't know about mm-hmm. Nixon, but I think it's a very important point.
Well, and you know, one of the things that Nixon continued to do throughout the late 60s into the 70s was make excuse after excuse why he couldn't just stop the Vietnam War. It went on 5 years. I mean, he got elected in 68 to saying that he was going to end the war. And in fact, nothing could have been farther from the truth. He didn't in his first term do it. And then, of course, he kept promising the same thing. They reelected him. And who was dying over there, Nancy, but poor people from the United States, both black and white, anybody who had, you know, poor skills in school or whatever, were over there dying. And all these congressmen's kids and the richer ones were finding ways of getting out of their service requirement and the rest of it. And so it became a poor guy's war over there, and it just horrendous. And he was guilty of a lot of things, this guy Nixon.
But also the other thing that Nixon and Kissinger did is when Nixon was running against Johnson, I believe.
Yeah.
They went behind, and this is something that has happened several times with these people. They went behind Johnson's back and did something which was actually treasonous. Johnson was trying to negotiate a treaty to stop the war in Paris. They were having peace talks. And Nixon and Kissinger actually was the ambassador through Nixon, undermined those peace talks and kept that war going much longer than it needed to go.
Yep, yep, yep.
People were ready to really, and that's been documented in several places. So Kissinger was somebody who had great authority, and the question I think you always have to ask, which Americans never seem to do, is to ask themselves, where does this man get his power and authority? He certainly doesn't get it. He's never been elected. He doesn't get it through the American people. So where does he get the power and authority to begin to manipulate foreign policy in the way that he's done?
Yeah.
Which is totally against the concept of the American state.
Well, I mean, he did more than that, though. I mean, a lot of people think that China was not in communication with the Western governments, so specifically the CIA and so forth. But again, I'm going to go back to Eustace Mullins' research when he stated that high-level contacts were made through the drug peddling. And, of course, we had Air America taking huge shipments of drugs out of just over the Chinese border where it was delivered into Laos and flown back to the Western world. And, of course, some of it went through the Marseille. Of course, the French connection comes to mind when you think about those connections and so forth. And my point being that these people were kept the crime gang flush with illegal money as well. So they were making money for the weapons builders as well as the crime, you know, the Lanskys of the world and the drug peddlers of the world and the big time mafioso of the world.
Well, my understanding in some respects of that Vietnam War also was that it actually was a war between two European powers, with using the Vietnamese as proxies, because as you know, the French that was part of their colonial empire. And the Corsicans were very much involved in money laundering and drug dealing for a long time, and they sort of controlled that trade out of Southeast Asia. So one of the things that the CIA did was begin to displace the Corsicans and the French and to take over that money source in Vietnam. Besides, I think there were also oil deposits off the coast, which they later developed.
Yeah, Spratly Islands are still under contention, and it's a fraudulent contention. But anyway, so what we've got is it's about money, it's about power, it's about control, but it's also about learning how modern warfare can affect societies. They were doing a lot of social engineering as a result of the decisions being made about Vietnam. And of course, one of the things they did when they saw the young people really starting to flare up and be angry at the way they were criminalizing this war was criminal, and basically leave it at that. But they had to control the public. They started inflicting serious drugs on the country, LSD and pills of every description. And you write a little bit about the availability of pharmaceutical drugs really opening up at that point. You want to talk a little bit about how that industry grew in the 60s and into the 70s?
Yeah, that was a really interesting time in the United States for the baby boom, what was called the baby boom generation, which is my generation, because prior to the Vietnam War, things were pretty calm for the most part in the United States. But around that time, any number of things began to happen. There was a civil rights movement that began to take form. There was a women's lib movement that began to take form. There was this new sexual freedom because of the birth control pill. And then because there was a universal draft at that time, the young men were outraged that they were going to have to be drafted to go off and fight in a war, which more and more people didn't really believe in. So there was a lot of social upheaval going on in the country at that time.
Well, you see a lot of the Zionists behind it, though, Nancy, especially with people like Bella Abzug and Gloria Steinem and so many. And then also the Zionists infiltrated the civil rights movement. And you see a lot of them setting up the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is just a front for the ADL. They did a lot of things in the name of civil rights that had nothing to do with civil rights, if you take a close look at it.
Well, that was one of the reasons why the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee began to move away from the concept of integration. That was, and people thought that was terrible at the time, but they began to understand how people were being manipulated to do certain things in a certain way that weren't actually going to benefit the African American community. But at any rate, there were a lot of social upheavals going on at that time, and so the CIA was really responsible for several things. Number one, they were running a program called MK Ultra, mm-hmm. which began to introduce psychedelic drugs into the youth scene, such as LSD, and other kinds of drugs began to show up. And then at the same time, the soldiers were coming back from Vietnam, many of them strung out on heroin, and they had also been introduced to a lot of drugs. So you had it was almost like a cauldron of things waiting to happen. You had changes in the social milieu. You had changes in sexual morality. You had this introduction of drugs into the youth scene. And you had this violent change within the society, which was being instigated in the background. So this was, it was almost like a train wreck waiting to happen.
Well, and they actually went further than that. They liberalized divorce laws and started allowing the breakup of families to take effect rather easily in most states. I remember as a kid, it was not legal to just walk in and get one of these no-fault divorce deals. And And all of a sudden, so people stopped working on relationships that were, in other instances, long term, and began, you know, all of this experimentation and, you know, I don't know, it was the 1970s is when I grew up. It's late 60s, early 70s. I'm a bit of less than a decade younger than you, but I was living through this nightmarish period. Now, it was lots of fun if you were anti-disestablishment, but disestablishmentarianist, if you'll allow the big word to be used. I was. I mean, everybody was. We, you know, we had sit-ins in school, and we were nut job, long hair and platform shoes, and you know, I mean, come on, we were doing everything we could to make the establishment upset with us. But it was really for naught. It was almost like window dressing on geopolitical events. It had no real effect. In my view, at least, I look back on it, and it was.
I think one of the brilliant strategies of the elites who rule the planet is that they know when they need to make adjustments, but they don't create any substantive change.
Well, that's exactly.
That's how they maintain their power, and the people who, the rest of us are slow to understand their strategies.
Well, now we move into the 70s, and of course Nixon's humiliation and resignation, and we move into having a real knucklehead who, on the surface, seems like he's a great guy for humanity. But you take a look at the people he had, Stansfield Turner, and I mean the guys that he had working for him were every bit as connected in the CIA group as anybody has ever been. Including this guy being an Admiral Rickover clone from the U.S. Navy. And so the guy's a walking fraud. Of course, I'm talking about Jimmy Carter. And we look into the Iran-Contra affair, politics of neighborhood destruction and cultural disintegration.
But Daryl, let me just, before we go on to the Iran-Contra, I just want to talk a little bit more about the Vietnam thing, because...
Okay.
Because the Chinese, in fact, were supplying weapons to the Viet Cong, and we were buying drugs. The CIA and other groups were buying drugs from the Chinese. So this is before we get into Iran-Contra, and I think people should understand that this has become a strategy in these countries where drugs are. You get the drugs, and drugs are like a currency. Drugs are like gold because people know that they can sell them. And so if you want to buy guns or weapons or whatever, you can use opium as a currency. And I think that sort of gets lost in the translation of this, because we always think of it in terms of people being addicted to them, but we don't understand that in the clandestine world, opium has been used for centuries as a currency. It's as good as gold.
Yeah. Well,
and so the what I consider to be traitorous was that while the American soldiers were fighting and dying in Vietnam, and Nixon was behind the scenes working with the same Chinese who were supplying the Viet Cong, was working to open the markets in China, knowing that once those markets were opened, there would be this incredible cheap labor pool that would begin to undermine the American economy.
Yeah. And so those were the seeds of this modern day globalization that has led to what we're seeing now is the formation of a world government. So, and this was all put into place then. And one of the things that they started doing in places like in New York City and Detroit and of course, the Los Angeles, we had the Watts riots. We had Detroit up in flames. Even places like New Bedford, Massachusetts went up in flames during this time. But we saw a destruction of inner city areas that were once thriving districts. They turned into... You just go back and watch movies like Shaft, or movies where they depicted inner city nightmares, or even movies like The Warriors. If you remember that it doesn't seem to have much punch, but back in my youth, a movie like Warriors was really indicative of the problems inner cities were all experiencing. It was horrendous. I mean, when we had New York City go bankrupt, we had bus systems failing. You know, people couldn't get on buses anymore. I mean, the city just crumbled all across America. And it was really the beginning of the end of the American dream, I think, because that's when you really saw the 1960s/70s turn into a American failed state, I think.
I think that was the beginning of it. I mean, I think it was very hard. We began to see those signs with the graffiti that was everywhere,
yep,
and the drugs that began to show up, and the dissolution of so many neighborhoods. And then, of course, in many areas of the country, the industry began to disappear. Now, I'm originally from the Midwest, so I was very aware of the. And I grew up around steel mills and of course, Akron, the rubber plant. So I grew up around manufacturing. And so when that manufacturing began to leave the country, I was very aware of it because as I went back to the Midwest, I could see the closed factories and I could see the towns that had once been very prosperous, thriving, middle-class towns, working-class towns were now... some of them were just devastated. The neighborhoods were gone.
Yep. And then, of course, what moves in behind that is a blight, social blight of all types, high divorce rates, child abuse, and it gave rise to a new industry that they've taken advantage of to this day, and that's the burgeoning prison industry where they actually own the companies that build the prisons, and they own the companies that manage them. And then their court system that they're in full control of skims money off of every arrest and every conviction. These maritime courts are all about money. And so fact of the matter is it was another money scam that was set up on the disintegration process. They skimmed off money. So where are we going now with the Iran-Contra deal and how... Reagan's period was ushered in because that was really when they came out of the shadows and actually took front and center roles in running the country. For example, people like Dick Cheney came out of, some people have referred to him as a crazy in the basement. He came up from the basement to the surface, and George Bush Sr. came out, and a lot of these heretofore criminals were now being elected into office and put in front and center positions?
Well, a couple of things. And Donald Rumsfeld I want to speak on particularly because I didn't really write about him in the book, but I do want to talk about him a little bit because he has been very instrumental in pushing certain drugs, pharmaceutical drugs, onto the American people. One of them is aspartame, which is a neurotoxin.
Yeah.
It's a sweetener found in many many soft drinks and foods that sometimes people don't even know it's there. But what happened during the next administration, Nixon also declared a war on drugs,
yeah,
and a war on cancer. So his war on cancer was very interesting because there was a man by the name of Otto Warburg. He was part of the Warburg banking family, but he was a scientist and a very good one. And he actually had understood the cause of cancer. He understood that the cause of cancer was a change in the energy metabolism of the cell. He won two Nobel Prizes and was nominated for a third for his discoveries. And by the 1960s, the late 1960s, his research was coming into fruition. And suddenly, the money was taken away from that line of research and was suddenly put into the line of research stating that viruses were the cause of cancer. And so now they were going to look for these viruses that were causing cancer. And so those are some of the historical landmarks that people overlook because they don't always connect those dots. But cancer is one of the most lucrative diseases that you can imagine. It makes a lot of money for the pharmaceutical companies. And so Nixon, his administration changed the way the research was going. And remember, without money, there's very little research because modern research requires a lot of technology and it requires a lot of equipment. And if you can't get your grants, if you're a scientist and you don't get those grants, you don't do your research, you don't get graduate students, you don't get tenure. So you go along with what the powers that be want you to go along with. So if they say, we want to find out if viruses cause cancer, that's what you're going to look at. And you're not going to look at the energy metabolism of cancer. And I think people fail. They think science is somehow this pure, apolitical kind of discipline. Nothing could be further than the truth.
Well, you know, I have some evidence to that. You're exactly right about the energy in cancer. I told you in a private call earlier about this vitamin K, and they said that is integral to the cancer outbreak. In other words, if you've got low vitamin K intake in your body, you've got skyrocketing cancer rates of all types. And
well, the thing that, again, the calcium, the vitamin K is part of the system of calcium metabolism. And when we talk about calcium metabolism, we're talking again about the energy. It's called the redox metabolism of the cell, and we're talking about cell signaling. So how the cell talks to each other and keeps itself healthy. And these are electrical signals. The basic part, how the cell maintains its integrity, is through electrical signals. These chemical things are secondary. Their big meaning is how they respond in the cell electrically or through electromagnetic radiation. So calcium is one of those very important chemicals that signal the proteins and the DNA to do certain things. That's why vitamin K is so important.
Well, and so basically people have continued researching the proper solutions to cancer in spite of the American Cancer Society still continuing to go down roads that have really borne very little fruit. People who get cancer these days, Nancy, go through a living hell, and more often than not survive only 2 or 3 years before they relapse because the real solutions haven't been made. They've just basically bought themselves some time, but it's time mostly suffering. I've seen many people in my family here have cancer, and basically the 5 years that they've had it has been a living hell for them. I mean, it's not...
Because, Daryl, this is something that's very important I want people to understand. Whether you have cancer, diabetes, heart disease, or whatever, you didn't get sick overnight. You began to start that process of showing up with a disease years before that disease showed up. And so the question that everyone has to ask, what are the things that I did in my life that I could undo over time to undo this process? Because many of these processes, if caught in time, can be reversed. And they can be reversed with the proper nutrition, the proper exercise, the right amount of water, and, of course, the proper vitamins and minerals. But these are things that are not focused on in allopathic medicine. Allopathic medicine basically uses drugs. Now, I believe that there are some drugs that are necessary, and I certainly don't think that all drugs should be removed from the market. But I think one of the things that we recently saw is that a report came out to show that 85% of the drugs on the market now have little effect.
Yes, right.
So that means there are a small number of drugs that we probably could use and survive with, and the rest of them basically are there for a profit center but are not have no efficaciousness. So why are they being sold?
Well, but they have an opposite effect than being effective. They actually, in combination, kill people. In fact, the number one killers of people in the Western world are doctors.
So,
I mean, Nancy, I don't know if you agree with that, but most people...
No, according to Gary Null, the number one killer of people in the United States is iatrogenic medicine. He has done a study, and he's written a book called Death by Medicine, in which he has gone through the literature and found that there are probably more than 700,000 deaths a year that can be attributed to medicine, and over 100,000 of those we know are by the drugs themselves.
So I mean, look, you know, we get upset. We lost 7,000 or 8,000 people in Afghanistan or Iraq, when in fact back home here we're losing people in the hundreds of thousands by a runaway medical system that now they have forced you to participate in.
So at any rate, when the Iran-Contra erupted, that was when, have you talked about Iran-Contra before?
I haven't. I mean, it's also has connections to the drug industry, to the illicit drug industry as well, of course. But it also has a lot to do with consolidating control over Central America. It has banking connections in Panama that go right through my Miami. One of the big banks that you'll get a name over and over and over again in today's world was built on that criminal money. It's called Santander. It is a Rothschild filial, and it is it was built on drug laundering money. So it's all there, and I have talked about a lot of the issues surrounding it, but not specifically that.
Yeah, because basically it was a big scam, and on the American people, because Congress had refused to support Reagan's, who wanted to support these group of what he called freedom fighters, but they were essentially terrorists called Sandinistas.
Yeah.
In Nicaragua. And so what they did is that, again, they started using drugs in order to buy arms that they traded to these terrorists. And also, at the same time, they were selling arms to Iran, the very people who they say now are developing an atomic bomb and that we should go and stop them. So there was all this, there's so much double dealing that goes on underneath what people seem to realize. And then they break out and there's this crime and people come to Congress, but nobody ever seems to be chastised, except this time a few people did go to jail. But a lot of people did not go to jail, especially George Bush Sr., who seemed to be in charge of running this affair from the White House. It was also involved in the savings and loan scandal. But in terms of the crack cocaine epidemic, this is when the crack cocaine epidemic started erupting in the inner cities. So the very powerful people from the White House of the United States of America, and this was documented in a book called, I'm blanking right now, it'll come to me, Dark Alliance, that they were dealing drugs from the White House.
Yeah.
And selling the drugs to the American people so they could finance their war.
And their own wealth. I mean, a lot of that was skimmed off and put into their own private bank accounts, I'm certain.
Exactly.
But
at the same time, but they were also doing something else. They were specifically targeting, Catherine Austin Fitz has documented this. Catherine Austin Fitz was former Undersecretary of HUD in the Reagan administration, and she has documented they were specifically targeting African-American and Hispanic communities with these drugs. Then after they targeted the community falling apart, and they were targeting people in communities where they wanted to do urban renewal. So the same people who were targeting these communities then came in and bought up the properties for pennies on the dollar, packaged them, and sold them into HUD parcels where they went into portfolios, knowing that those portfolios were going to rise in value over the coming years. But a lot of people who were working people lost their incomes and they lost their investments in their homes, because if you have a home in a crack neighborhood that was valued at one time at $100,000 and now your kids are no longer safe and there are drive-by shootings, your house is no longer worth very much.
That's
and
right.
So a lot of people just walked away from those houses.
And
so this idea that black people, and I'm really tired of it, this idea that black people don't want to take care of their neighborhoods is nonsense. Black people in the United States have been under constant attack by the powers that be in this country for a long time. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that people don't have to take responsibility for themselves, but it does mean that people are intentionally being targeted with drugs and with other kinds of things that would destroy any neighborhood.
And what I've also seen, Nancy, from my own evidence, so this is, you know, and I've been at this long enough to see it, once they find an established method of doing their destructive deeds, they actually use the template and bring it on to the white community. I mean, many people have said, if you want to know what the divorce rate in the black community has done in the early 1960s, 10 years hence, you will see what it does in the white community. You'll see drug problems in the inner city black community, and then a few years later, it's in the suburbs doing the same kind of horrible damage. In other words, it's just a delayed reaction into the rest of the country, and they introduce a lot of these horrible degradations on the society through the black community intentionally, but it always ends up in the society at large, and we can see that without having to look very hard at it. It's absolutely clear that that's the way things go, and I guess it's a, you know, the kind of crimes that we're talking about here, Nancy, are they're beyond treason. You have to be, you have to be a psychopath to accept these kinds of behaviors from people. These people are insane. I mean, what kind of human beings would actually target entire city areas for addiction and for shootings and murder? Who would think this way?
It's the same kind of people who would target the Chinese with opium. I mean, it's just, and I say this in my book, I use this refrain over and over again, it's just business. These people do things for business reasons. They could care less what the consequences are to the social fabric of any country. Because remember, if you consider yourself a globalist, you're not really identified with a particular country.
That's right.
And I think that's very, very difficult for people in whatever country you're living in, whether you're France or Germany or the United States or Brazil, or Ghana or Nigeria. I think that people are having a very difficult time understanding that at the elite level, these people don't identify with a country. They see themselves, they're sort of like international peddlers, and they don't have an allegiance. They could live in any country. They have the money and the means, and so the country is unimportant to them. So whether a country is undermined or not undermined has no, it means nothing. What they want is they want their businesses to do well. They want to manipulate people so that they can get what they want out of people. They want to sell them whatever products they want, and they don't really care about the consequences to the people, the planet, or anything, except as long as they are making money.
Well, we've done a you know, now we can move into kind of a segue into the it was the eugenics blueprint and the creating and sustaining a medical crisis. Now, of course, I told you not long ago, I'm watching more and more people my age dying of cancer, several of them recently, three people I know in the last couple of weeks, I've read in my local newspaper online, have died, and they're 53 years old, they've died of cancer. And these are before 10 years ago, I mean, they didn't live stressful lifestyles, they've just come into contact with some environmental toxins, didn't do anything positive in their nutritional area, and they just died. They fell victim to cancer. But it's not just my hometown. This is an epidemic worldwide. The French are going through cancer epidemic as well, Nancy. It's incredible. But you write here about sustaining a medical crisis. We are in one. There is no doubt about it.
You know, it's really interesting because I've been thinking a lot about this. How do you, you know, during the Second World War, people were outraged because of some of what the doctors did in Germany during the Second World War, and also with the eugenics that culminated with the death of people that they considered defectives.
Yep.
But that had been going on in the United States for a while, because there is an idea, and it's the eugenics idea, that there are certain people who shouldn't breed. And these people also have the idea that there are too many people on the planet anyway. So I think the question that they had to ask themselves, how can we actually limit the population and do experimentation on the population, but make it look as if we are actually helping the population?
And you know who comes to mind immediately? What's his name over here? Bill Gates and Melinda Gates Foundation. My goodness. With their inoculations in Africa and so forth, secretly putting some RB factor inside of their stuff to make people sterile. This is the kind of stuff that's going on all around us. But where do you, in this particular chapter 11, what specific experiences do you discuss in that chapter?
Well, the one that I really want to focus on is the pellagra story, which took place mostly in the southern part of the United States. Pellagra is a nutritional deficiency of a vitamin called niacin. It's one of the B vitamins. And basically it's characterized by some of the same things that they say happen with immune deficiency today, because people who are niacin deficient do develop an immune deficiency. They develop dermatitis, dementia, diarrhea, and eventually, if it was left untreated, they would die. But at the same time, because their immune system was compromised, they developed all kinds of infectious problems as well. And so the eugenics movement, who were very, I call them East Coast liberals, the Harrimans and people of that type, were very prominent people who put a lot of money into this. I think it's classist. In the United States, it turned out to be more racist than classist, but they held these beliefs in Europe also.
Yeah.
And that's what happened during the Second World War. But they felt that if people weren't worthy of living, then they should die. But they had the idea that these people, many of the freed people who were maybe one or two generations away from slavery, were very poor. And, of course, the conditions in the South, both among poor whites and blacks, was very terrible up through the Depression. Yeah. So many people didn't have enough food, and they were both mostly eating cornmeal kinds of products and pork. And that was it. They weren't eating a lot of vegetables, and they weren't eating much other meat. And as a result of this terrible diet, they developed this deficiency, this vitamin deficiency. And a researcher from New York, from the United States Public Health, went to the South and did very good research to find out that this was a nutritional problem, that it was not an infectious problem. And the eugenics people buried that research for over 20 years. And they did the same thing that they are doing now with the AIDS research. They are calling people, you know, at that time they didn't call them denialists, but they hired doctors who would go along with this infectious disease problem, and they called the people who said that it was a nutritional problem, they called them crazy, and they tried to ostracize them. And it went on for over 20 years until the Great Depression, when many people were food insecure, and the government started supplying food, and the problem kind of went away. And it was found that the eugenics people knew for over 20, because they had the research, that this was a nutritional problem and not an infectious problem, but they sat on the research because they intentionally wanted these people not to survive.
So now, when they went down there, they administered nicotinic acid or niacinamide, and immediately these people's conditions began to reverse, I'm sure.
Well, they weren't that sophisticated, because niacin really hadn't been isolated at that time, but the researchers noted that if this were an infectious process, then the doctors and nurses who worked with these people, some of them should also have the disease, right?
And they didn't. Yeah.
But they didn't. And it's the same thing with the HIV/AIDS thing. If this is such an infectious process and it can be transmitted by blood, then a lot of the doctors and nurses who get needle sticks all the time should have been infected, and we cannot find that in the literature. The doctors and nurses who have had HIV or AIDS all have risk factors that have nothing to do with their profession.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing all over again.
Well, now we talk, Bertrand Russell comes to mind, and people like George Bernard Shaw, when they not only did this eugenics take effect on the ground, they began promoting the idea of culling the useless eaters out of the herd in literature, and they did it in popular culture as well. So what it kind of does is desensitizes people to the plight of the poor, and you can see that same kind of thought process going on today, where cities like Las Vegas make it illegal for you to feed people that are homeless. You can go to jail for giving a homeless person a sandwich.
Well, this is the way, again, this idea that we become desensitized to each other's plight makes us more willing to do the bidding of these people when they want their bidding to be done.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think right now, because we're in such an unstable period, people have to be really aware of that. For example, right now in the United States, they are really trying to stigmatize the Hispanic community and the Muslim community.
Yep.
Now, I think that people should come to this country legally. However, why are people coming here? We never talk about NAFTA anymore. We never talk about the consequence that NAFTA has had on both Mexico or the United States. We seldom talk about why Mexico has devolved into a narco state. But we just deal with these things as if they just happen. These things don't just happen. And I'm really actually tired of people who think that these things just happen, that there aren't people who are making these things happen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, anybody who's done the research, Nancy, knows clearly that these are all by design. I'm call me a conspiracy theorist. I'm proud of the title. I mean, they've even tried to make people who have that as part of their moniker look like they're crazy. But hey, when crimes are being committed, it's a conspiracy. And
In the legal profession, sometimes if you can't get people on the crime, conspiracy is one of the most common crimes committed.
That's right.
And all it requires is two people who get together to commit a crime, and they have one act in furtherance of that crime. So so if you decide that you want to bring drugs into the United States, that's a crime. And if you have two people who've gotten together who decide that they're going to be bringing drugs into the United States, then that's a conspiracy to commit a crime.
That's right. That is right. Well, let's talk a little bit, because we got to get through a couple more chapters here, actually five or six more. Burroughs, welcome. Now, we know that there was a lot of consolidating that has gone on from the mid-1980s all the way through until about 6-8 years ago, with Santa Fe Synthalabo and some of these others. But we had Burroughs and Smith Klein, Beecham, and Merck, and all of these major poison factories, I'll call them, Bayer and the rest of them, working to consolidate the different individual companies into these huge poison conglomerates, if you will. Most of these drugs they come out with now. I have an aunt that took some drugs, and now she's handicapped for life after taking some kind of thing for her diabetes, in fact, and it was almost killed her. But of course, there's hundreds of stories like this. What do you write here about them in the Eye of the Storm, Burroughs Welcome?
Well, the reason I focus on Burroughs Wellcome is because they were a drug company that produced a group of drugs that had a particular chemical configuration that is immune suppressive. They had a nitrogen and oxygen side chain, and these drugs were known to be immunosuppressive. And for example, one of the drugs that I write about is azathioprine. And I don't want to get too technical, but essentially azathioprine was given to people who were having transplants, for example, a kidney transplant or a liver transplant. And the reason you want to immune suppress someone who is getting a transplant, because that transplant is a foreign object and your body will reject it. And so if you're giving someone a transplant, you don't want them to reject it, so you want to suppress their immune system, and so that until that the body gets adjusted to that particular foreign object. So one of those drugs was azathioprine. Now, one of the things that I found in the transplantation literature is that a subset of people who were given this drug developed what I call transplantation AIDS. That is, they developed Kaposi sarcomas, lymphomas, and opportunistic infections. And the people who most often developed these particular problems had a particular type of protein on their blood cells. These are tissue typing proteins, because when you give someone a transplant, you have to tissue type to see if there's any kind of a match. Now, eventually this particular protein became one of the HIV antibody proteins. But what happened is that they discovered that a certain subset of people who were given these drugs, when the drugs were stopped, the cancers would go away. The Kaposi sarcoma would go away. The lymphomas would resolve, and the opportunistic infections would be able to be controlled. So they already knew that these things so that shows you that there are certain cancers that were reversible. They knew that from this drug situation with these patients. And now this is very profound, because this was these transplant patients were being given this drug before and around the time that AIDS was showing up in the emergency rooms. So in the literature, the doctors knew that you could induce immune deficiency with a drug. Besides that, there was 100 years of literature showing that opium and opium products, opiates, were immune deficient. And also the literature is very clear that cocaine, and especially crack cocaine, is even more causes more immunodeficiency than opium products. So all of these things were known in the literature. So that was a big clue. Then, of course, the other drug that was partly responsible for developing this immune deficiency crisis was a drug called amyl nitrite. And in the gay community, it was known as poppers, because you popped a little glass vial and you sniffed this particular drug. This drug had originally been developed for people who had something called angina, which is a heart problem. You get chest pains, and it allowed the blood vessels to dilate, and so the pain would abate. But it became popular in the gay scene because it allowed blood to flow to the penis, it relaxed the anal sphincter, and it gave a little bit of a high. So it facilitated homosexual sex. And so it was used in almost all the guys who showed up who developed Kaposi sarcoma were using a lot of this amyl nitrite.
Well, what I understand from talking to Dr. Day, who was the chief of surgery of San Francisco Medical Center, she was the head surgeon there for over a decade. She said she has done surgery on more so-called AIDS patients than anybody in the world, And what she said was that lifestyle was the cause of AIDS, not a virus, as you've pointed out. But she also said that the dangers of homosexual activity are inherent in the practice. In other words, coming in contact with different parts of you're not supposed to have contact with other people's feces and the rest of it, because there are inherent dangers in that, especially if you are in a state of a weakened state to start with. You're setting yourself up on many fronts to become ill.
Well, remember that AIDS was never widespread in the homosexual community. There was a subset of people who had a particularly fast-track lifestyle.
Yeah, they were going to the bathhouses.
I want that to be clear.
But they were going to bathhouses and having.
I understand that.
Yeah, but I mean, they were going to bathhouses and having multiple.
They were having the kind of sex that really, this is probably a family program. So these are things that probably don't need to be discussed.
Right. Right.
But needless to say, there were sexual activities that were taking place that weren't healthy.
Yep.
So, and the other thing that we do know is that we do know that a semen is also highly oxidizing. That means that it can cause tissue damage. And when it's deposited in the rectum, rectal tears can occur, and then it can get into the bloodstream, and it could cause tissue damage. So, which has a very, and of course the vagina is much thicker than the rectum, and so these same problems don't occur when men and women have sex, because the vagina is able to neutralize the semen and it won't go into the bloodstream through vaginal sex. So that was also a big deal.
So what we're seeing here is a subset of people who did ultimately show the signs of this so-called viral disease, even though what we can demonstrate today, it was more lifestyle. But we also know that people who use drugs and have out of control relationships of the type we just discussed are actually not treating themselves in a way that's going to be conducive to good health. For example, most heroin addicts don't eat well. They spend a lot of their money and time getting their drug of choice, and instead of taking care of sleeping in a warm place or getting a good nutrition and so forth. And so basically, there's a layer of lifestyle problems on top of the substance problems or the sexual activity problems. It's several different factors that are all coming into play at once. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, there doesn't, the factors can be infectious, psychological, nutritious, environmental, toxins. It really doesn't matter. At the biochemical and energy level, the response is going to be the same if you're doing these damaging things chronically over time.
Yeah.
And this is where this is something very important, because people are all over the place, calcium, vitamin K, this vitamin, that vitamin. The issue, again, is I want to get back to the concept of energy metabolism. The wonderful thing about living beings is that we have the ability to store and use energy instantaneously, and that's what keeps us alive. And the way we get energy into our system is through food, through water, through air. And those things need to be pristine, because if they're not, then our body is losing energy simply trying to metabolize them. And one of the problems that has happened over the last century is that there are so many poisons in our environment that our bodies are overwhelmed with using up the energy, trying to neutralize these toxins. Over time, if you don't have enough energy flowing in your system, whatever your predisposition is, you're going to show up with some kind of a disease, whether it's immune deficiency, cancer, diabetes, or whatever.
So essentially, they went after the weakest in the social strata, and of course, they started showing all these outward signs of what they described as AIDS. Now, what you say here.
They weren't the weakest. They were the most ostracized. And what happened is that over time, because of lifestyle, they were using up you know, when you're born, you have lots of stores of energy, and as you eat the right things, those things are renewed. But if you're going to take toxins and poisons into your system over time, your body is not going. It's just like using your car, Daryl. If you keep driving your car and don't put gas into the tank, or you don't keep your battery charged, your car, your engine is eventually going to burn out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. You know, we talk here. It says why is HIV is not transmitted sexually? I think we treated that in some way because first of all, it's not a virus, and that's why. I mean, it's not viral in nature. Although some of the things they were claiming as side effects of HIV were being transmitted, that had nothing to do with any specific condition of HIV, because HIV, in fact, is just basically someone's overall condition degrading and falling victim to opportunistic problems.
Well, the epidemiology of HIV and every study that's been done, large, long-term studies, have not shown that that this particular problem is sexually transmitted. Whether the studies done in the United States, Europe, and Africa, and there have been studies on all three continents that essentially have come to the same conclusion, and there's no evidence that HIV from these large epidemiological studies, and also from other epidemiological studies, there's no evidence that HIV is a sexually transmitted disease.
Well, you say here that it's now. What you don't know about HIV antibody tests can kill you. How so?
Well, first of all, the people think that the HIV test tests for the virus. It doesn't. It's an indirect test. It tests for what Gallo claimed were these HIV proteins or sugar proteins, glycoproteins. But if you have not isolated the virus, you don't know what the proteins of the virus should be. But these are proteins that he took the blood from multiple patients who were very ill, and he used that blood to patent an antibody test before he had truly isolated the virus that the test was supposed to identify. And the problem is that this test, there's not one package insert that says that this test can be used to identify HIV. And furthermore, the test has been shown to cross-react with at least 70 different things. For example, right now, the National Institute of Health in the United States is pushing everyone to get a flu vaccine. And a flu vaccine is one of the vaccines that cross-reacts with the HIV antibody test. So if you get the flu vaccine and you have an HIV test within 6 months and it shows up positive, how are you going to know if that's truly something you have to be concerned about?
Well, clearly we know that it's a fraud to start with here. And I mean, so
but
yes.
But the other thing that, Daryl, you have to recognize that test has some validity in some people. For example, it may indicate that certain people have an energy situation which needs to be looked at. So, but there are better tests for that. And so I think that even if someone tests HIV positive, it doesn't relieve the doctor of the responsibility for finding out what the underlying pathology is.
Well, I mean, you know, now we come across fewer and fewer people talking about AIDS because the science. How many doctors in practice today are aware that HIV is not truly what it's been described as? How many of the you know, workaday medical professionals know there's something awry with the way they've come to, you know, to put this stuff out into the public?
Well, there are very few because there are hundreds of doctors who've signed letters and who've tried to get this information out. But I think people would be amazed at, even in this day of all of the internet and satellites, of how people can keep information pretty tight.
Yep.
And information that they don't want people to know. And it's the same as during the pellagra time. Is that if you're a doctor and you have a different opinion, remember, this has become, the AIDS doctrine has become a religion.
Yep.
So they shout you down. And very prominent scientists such as Peter Duisberg, who's been who's one of the most prominent world-renowned virologists, he's been questioning this for over 20 years. Yet he cannot be, no one will talk to him. He's lost his graduate students. He's lost his funding for his lab. And so he's become a pariah in the community. It's almost like a Salem witch hunt.
Yep. Yep. Well, they did it with climate studies as well. I mean, they've got, if you come out and say factually that, that the temperatures in the last decade have actually dropped by 2 degrees centigrade, you are shouted down as a quack. And I mean, you've walking around with a PhD in meteorology, and you know what you've looked at the statistics, and you come out with it, Nancy, and all of a sudden you lose your job, you lose your national atmospheric support, and all of a sudden
science has become so politicized it's no longer science, and
isn't.
And unfortunately, people are suffering as a result. So my problem is that whether you believe in the virus or don't believe in the virus, the point of it is if people are not getting well and you're giving them drugs that are these antiretroviral drugs that actually are killing them, causing heart, liver, and lung damage, then there's a problem. And my God, people, I think, went into medicine to help people, not to harm them. And so I'm asking physicians to do is take a second look at this. When people are nutritionally deficient, you have an obligation to find out what the problem is and to compensate them.
Now, you talk about that in the next chapter is what is causing the immune deficiency. And again, we have discussed it throughout this program. That it's a host of things, including lifestyle and possible medications, possible lack of a balanced diet. It could be emotional stresses. Of course, stress has a big effect on your immune system. So it could be a host of things, and so those all need the treatment, not the so-called AIDS. What we need to do is strengthen that person's overall health in a general sense, and all of a sudden you're going to see many of the markers for this so-called AIDS begin to vanish even.
Well, the biggest deficiency, which was noted early on, was which is a tripeptide, which is three amino acids, is something called glutathione, and glutathione has a sulfur and a hydrogen molecule attachment. And this is one of the ways in which the body stores energy. Again, we get back to the storage of energy. And when this particular molecule is used up, the body is not able to function effectively. And this glutathione deficiency seems to be a big problem in people who go on to develop one of the 29 or more diseases associated with AIDS. Remember that AIDS is not a disease per se. It's a syndrome in which they have put many diseases under one umbrella. But many of these problems have to do, again, with this particular deficiency of these energy molecules. And so I think that the doctors need to get back to what Otto Warburg was talking about. They need to really begin to understand the metabolism that happens in the mitochondria of the cell. And they need to begin to understand that when people are ill, it's giving them a drug will solve the symptom problem, but it's not going to solve the underlying disease problem.
Well, you talk about the secret what is the secret you refer to as a way of addressing this? Is this what you just discussed now, that secret?
Well, the secret, I think, is that one of the most important things about being an educated person doesn't have anything to do with how many years you go to school. Mm-hmm. It has to do with whether or not your heart and mind are congruent, that you're doing what your destiny is in the world, and that you learn how to understand when people are hoodwinking you.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and you learn how to see when someone is trying to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Now, some people want to be hoodwinked because the truth is not always so pretty.
Yeah.
But if you begin to, you yourself have the ability to walk out of this craziness, that this paradigm that is being created for us. It's a mental jail more than anything.
Yeah, I agree. I face that every day with the subjects I treat on this programming. I get shouted down as aggressively as any doctor would talking about AIDS. I have to say, you know, putting this stuff out and being called names for it, of course, you don't feel like the work you're doing is being valued. However, why do you do it? Because the truth somehow has to hold a special place in your mind and in your heart, or what is it all about? Why are we here if I have to live in a deluded, fraudulent state of existence? This, I'm not being valued. I'm not valuing myself or my intellect. And I have to stand up and say this is fraud. This is not right. And of course, this medical thing has gone on for it's going on a better part of a century now. And this what do you call it? A medical dictatorship is what I'm calling it. And they've just put another piece of the puzzle together with this new healthcare bill. So
This healthcare bill is going to be a disaster, and people are going to have far fewer freedoms, because one of the things they've been trying to do is you see every year or so they have a new H1N1, SARS, bird flu, you know, and so now with this bill they're probably going to start saying, well, you have to get your vaccine. But I think if they start doing that, I think they're going to see a lot of very unhappy people, because I know when they, in New York State last year or year before last, when they tried to say that all the doctors and nurses had to get these vaccines, they had people sitting on the state of the Capitol in New York, and the doctors and nurses were not going for it.
Wow, this is a positive. The last chapter says therapeutic considerations for HIV positive and AIDS patients. What recommendations can you give as a closing to this conversation we're having, Nancy?
Well, again, I want to talk about the most important nutrient is the glutathione, but the way you take in glutathione is general. Well, first of all, I would suggest that people find somebody who's either an allopath who's dealt with the nutritional aspects of immune deficiency, or a good holistic nutritionist who is able to help you. But the glutathione, the way we take it in is through a nutrient called N-acetylcysteine. But that particular enzyme that makes it also needs selenium. So maybe you're deficient in selenium. So maybe you're deficient in vitamin D. So maybe you're deficient in any number of other substances. And so in the book, I list those things. And that's why the antioxidants that you need are any numbers, and any numbers could be deficient. For example, one of the things you talked about was vitamin K, but coenzyme Q10, beta-glucans, L-arginine, polyunsaturated fatty acids, omega-3 fatty acids. Those are things that we are in our Western diet. We're not getting enough of those nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is hormonal balancing, and one of the last things I talk about, which people in traditional medicine very seldom talk about, is water. So many people are dehydrated, and your water molecule, in terms of your energy metabolism, is probably the most important molecule in your body.
So the other thing is, Nancy, I have to say, that is, if you're making two steps forward with nutritional solutions to your problems, you can't be taking two steps back by allowing all of the other environmental stresses that were present to give you that problem to continue. In other words, so many people think, oh, well, I'll take a multivitamin, I'll take this and that, and then they go and sit down and eat foods full of MSG, drink a couple of Diet Cokes with aspartame, and then, you know, and then stay out all night and drink up the thing and do a few drugs and party out, and then all of a sudden, all of this, you know, the vitamins they take, and they say, oh, I still feel terrible. Well, you can't take too soon, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's why I talk about the secret, because the secret is about being conscious.
Mm.
You know, I think many, many times, and I certainly am as guilty as anyone else, we live our lives without being conscious of what we're doing. We are conscious beings, and we can make every moment of our lives is a choice. And I'm sorry, I believe most people know what good choices and bad choices are.
Yep.
Some of us, however, because of the information that we get on television or wherever we get our information, are confused about the proper choices. But in today's world, with the internet, with libraries, there are lots of ways to get good information.
Yeah.
And so being conscious about what you do, about your relationships, about your job, about the energy that you put into the world and the energy that you allow around you. For example, if you're in a terrible relationship, whether it's with your family or with the person that you think you love, if it's not a relationship that is supporting you as a human being, then you need to be out of those relationships.
Well, and stress, again, has a huge effect on how we live. And I mean, I go back to the book written by Norman Vincent Peale, and it seems to have fallen off the bookshelves these days. But The Power of Positive Thinking. If that's the starting point for people, and you'll accept the fact that through those kinds of mental disciplines, you can start changing other things in your life. See, all of this stuff has to start with the first decision. That first decision means I want to have a positive outcome in my daily life, in my future, and so it starts now. And that's what Norman Vincent Peale talked about. He wrote this book back in the 50s. I don't know if you've ever put your eyes in that book.
Absolutely, it's a wonderful. I think it's because Norman Vincent Peale was somebody who the doctors, who had a serious disease, the doctors told him he was going to die, and he decided no, he wasn't going to do that, and he learned how to laugh. And he learned how to bring positivity in his life in such a way that he actually healed himself.
Yep.
And which goes to show you the power of the mind.
Yep. And see, but all of the subsequent decisions that you make regarding your health all have to be prefaced by the right attitude to go into those changes. If you don't start with the attitude in the first instance, you're not going to get to the final outcome of good health. It all has to begin with that first step, and that first step is changing the way you go forward from this point on. And I make mistakes with my health, Nancy. You know I do, and I think everybody has a two step forward, one back moment in their daily lives or in their weekly lives. However, and the aggregate for me, because I eat out of a garden and I do sleep well enough, and I do. Enough things around in my life to have positive, healthful outcomes, I have seen a change. It's evident to me. And, of course, sometimes when I, don't get do the wrong thing and don't get enough of one thing or the other, the prices I pay are immediately evident. And, of course, all of this is about learning because, being a child of the 70s, I learned some pretty bad behaviors. I mean, I didn't learn them. They were in me. I mean, my goodness, the society was living a destructive life. And the result of that's going to be more people at 53 that I knew, or 54 and 55, that they're going to start dying. This stuff that they inflicted on this people in the baby boom generations, ours and yours together, were destructive.
And I also want to say this, Daryl, because sometimes people are also we all have our weak moments, and so that's human. But we getting back on the right track and not giving up on ourselves is
right.
What the most important thing is. The other thing is taking responsibility for ourselves. For example, many people will go to the doctor and they'll take their drug and they won't do anything else.
Yeah.
That's not the end of it. That's just the beginning of it.
Yeah.
And so if you, I hear people that have diabetes and they go like, oh, I'm going to have to take this insulin or these Avandi or whatever for the rest of my life. But because the doctors, some of the doctors will say, you can take the drug, you can eat the cake, just take more drugs. What kind of idiocy is that? And anybody who has a doctor who would say something like that to them needs to be running out of that office.
Yeah.
So this is also a problem. People must begin to take responsibility for this. It's not the doctor's responsibility to take control of your health. It's your responsibility.
Well, that's right. And part of it has to be, but see, you know something, when you see the world crumbling around you, you see the problems, everything, people want to live in a deluded world. It seems to be a more pleasant place for them. And I find it so difficult to enlist people to look at the truth about any subject, Nancy, because it requires them to invest themselves emotionally in the truth. And it doesn't have to be. It could be about climate change or AIDS or Zionism or whatever the question might be within the conversation. But they don't want to be there. And I see it with talking to my neighbors. I see it talking to family members. It is a delusional state that people want to remain in, and it's very difficult to get them out of it. So part of the biggest job I think we have is finding inroads into shaking people out of that. And I think the first one that people have to recognize is that watching television for more than 25 minutes or a half hour a day is highly toxic for the mind. And everybody I ever known have ever known that can face facts and get on with their lives are not TV watchers.
Well, I would, you know, I don't know what if they have a public library system in France. But
oh, sure.
One of the things that when I was young, they didn't have the bookstores in small towns that they do now. Is the public library was a wonderful place to go to find out what was going on in the world. And people are still writing books that are telling the truth. But I would tell people to please read. Don't believe me. Don't believe Daryl. Mm-hmm. Find out for yourself. Mm-hmm. Read. And come to your own conclusions.
Yeah.
And if you take the time to read, and to not get so angry, but to understand that these people are doing what they're doing for a particular purpose, that you don't have to believe what they want you to believe.
Yeah.
You can begin to make your own decisions, and that's the power of The Secret.
Well, we've come to the end of this conversation and the book. I want you to give out your website address once again, and so that people can maybe send you an email about getting a book directly from you, Nancy. The book is already available at Amazon and at Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, the name of the book is AIDS, Opium, Diamonds, and Empire, The Deadly Virus of International Greed. And my website is nancybanks.us, and it's still under construction, but it's almost finished, Daryl.
Okay. Well, when you get that, I'm going to have it up on the website. I did put some of our other work that we've done. Your Flexner article up was put up once again for people to read and so forth. And there are other interviews that Nancy and I have done together over the last few years. Nancy Turner Banks, MD, friend, patriot, humanist. You're a great lady, Nancy, good friend of mine. I'm proud of you. I'm proud of the book that you've written. And it's pushing the envelope here a little bit, and it's great. It's great. How has it been received by other doctors? Do you know? Have you had any feedback?
From a few, and the people who are reading it are really inspired. Also, some nurses who are reading it, because I think there are a lot of things in here that people just they just didn't know, and I think I put the information together, both the scientific information and historical information, in a way that it begins to make sense.
Well, it's a seminal work. It's fabulously written, and it's actually. Your writing style is very easy, and so you've got a bit of a novelist in you there as well. Maybe we'll get a novel out of you by soon. You know, something.
Yeah, I could make some money on a novel.
You know, tell a love story of sorts. Maybe that'll go. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for listening in on this. Make sure you listen to the first part. You know, this is a two part file. Actually, we've got the entire book generally talked about, but there's a whole lot more in each chapter than what we discussed, and you know, this is something that everyone needs to read. Everyone needs, because it doesn't just talk about AIDS. This is not the sole import of this book, but rather it talks about health and choices and politics and how we got here in history, and it's ticking the boxes all the way down the row here. So, but until the next time, I want you all please to take care of your families. Lots of difficult financial moments are in our future. In fact, they're happening right now as we speak. So pay attention to them. Help people up that ladder. If they're falling behind, reach down and grab them and pull them up with you. And until the next time, this is Daryl Bradford Smith telling you all, please be well. Bye-bye now.